Afghanistan's government imposes a nationwide nighttime curfew in a bid to limit the Taliban militants' movements. The coronavirus pandemic continues to take its toll on Southeast Asia as the number of infections continue to rise in the region. And the death toll from floods and landslides in India jumps to 125 as rescue teams struggle to find survivors. Hello and welcome to World News. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Appreciate you being with us. First story takes us to Afghanistan this hour, where the Afghan government has imposed a nighttime curfew across all but three of the country's 34 provinces. Well, the Interior Ministry says the curfew is aimed at curbing violence and limiting the Taliban militants' movement. It will be enforced from 10 p.m. to 4 a.m. local time. Kabul, Panjshir, and Nangarhar are the only provinces where curfews have not been declared. The Taliban launched a widespread offensive across the country in early May. The militants now control about half of Afghanistan's districts. This while U.S.-led foreign forces are leaving the country they invaded 20 years ago. The pullout is expected to be completed by the end of August. Well, a top Iraqi official has reiterated that his country doesn't need U.S. combat troops on its soil anymore. National Security Advisor Qasem al-Araghchi said Baghdad has communicated its stance over the issue for Washington. The comment came ahead of a meeting between senior Iraqi and American officials in Washington on Monday, where they are expected to issue a statement on a possible exit of U.S. combat troops from Iraq by the end of this year. Iraq's Prime Minister Mustafa al-Khadhimi and Foreign Minister Fuad Hussein have also underlined that Washington needs to pull out its forces from the Arab country. In January of 2020, Iraq's parliament issued a resolution demanding the expulsion of American forces. That followed the U.S.'s assassination of top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani and Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Mohandes. The Iraqi foreign minister says a deal on the withdrawal of the United States' combat forces from his country is imminent. It appears, however, that Washington isn't willing to withdraw all of its military personnel from Iraq. And the word withdrawal itself is in question, since American forces will have an advisory role.
On Friday, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with visiting Iraqi Foreign Minister Fuad Hussein at the State Department. The meeting comes ahead of discussions on the role of U.S. military forces in Iraq. U.S. media have cited American officials as saying that the two countries are expected to formalize the end of Washington's combat mission in Iraq by the end of the year. That shift is reportedly planned to be announced on Monday when U.S. President Joe Biden hosts Iraqi Prime Minister at the White House. It could potentially mark a new chapter in the ties between the U.S. and Iraq, 18 years after Washington deployed its troops in the West Asian country. In an interview, the Iraqi foreign minister said the presence of American combat units in Iraq is unnecessary at this stage. He said what Iraq needs is cooperation in intelligence and training, as well as Air Force support. Earlier this week, Iraqi Prime Minister also stressed that American combat troops should leave his country.
I believe that the U.S. will not fully disengage from Iraq. My guess is they will leave some troops there in at least an advisory capacity, and also that they will augment the official military with private contractors. I don't expect the U.S. to totally leave Iraq.
In the meantime, resistance movements in Iraq say the presence of the U.S. forces in the Arab country will only benefit Israel.
The U.S. claims its 2,500 troops stationed in Iraq are focusing on fighting the Daesh terror group. Reports suggest Washington doesn't intend to draw down those numbers. Instead, it seeks to replace them with personnel focusing on the advisory mission. Nevertheless, Iraqi National Security Advisor Qasem al-Araji says his country doesn't need American combat troops on its soil anymore.
Anti-U.S. sentiments in Iraq have been running high since January 2020, when Washington assassinated Iran's top general, Qasem Soleimani, along with the deputy commander of the PMU forces, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, in an airstrike near Baghdad airport. Following the assassination, the Iraqi parliament adopted a resolution that called on the government to end the presence of all foreign troops in the country. Iraqi resistance groups have pledged to take up arms against U.S. forces if Washington fails to comply with the parliamentary order. While the U.S. justifies its presence in Iraq with fight against Daesh, Iraqis are stressing that they don't need foreign troops and that they're capable of dealing with the issue themselves.
The U.S., at least at times, has assisted groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda, and I expect the U.S. to continue to do that. The reason the U.S. will stay in Iraq is to be able to have a base of operations from which to attack Iran and Syria and other countries and entities in the Middle East that the U.S. deems to be enemies.
On the other hand, the fact that apart from Daesh terrorists, the U.S. is the only perpetrator of attacks on Iraq's anti-terror popular mobilization units, which are legally incorporated as part of the Iraqi military, puts the U.S. claim of fighting terrorists in perspective.
Going back to our previous story dealing with Afghanistan and the implementation of a nighttime curfew to help curb the situation that's taking place as far as with people taking over more of the country, the Taliban. I'm going to cross over to Kabul now and talk to Amin Alami. Amin, tell us the latest from what I'm hearing. 34 provinces at least now will be under the curfew. Tell us exactly what has taken place and why the government has chosen to do this and what exactly it means.
Well, Marcia, the Afghan government, particularly Afghanistan's Interior Ministry, declared that the night curfew is going to be implemented across 31 out of 34 provinces of Afghanistan. Kabul, Panjshir, and Nangarhar are considered as those provinces that these new rules will not be implemented across those areas. But the rest of 31 provinces will experience such plan of the Afghan government. According to the Afghan Interior Ministry as well as the Afghan Defense Ministry, the plan is going to be implemented because to avoid the influence of Taliban militants or their entrance during the nights in across big cities in Afghanistan, mainly in Kandahar in southern Afghanistan, Mazar-e-Sharif in northern Afghanistan, and Herat in western part of this country, because these cities are considered as the most important and most strategic cities across Afghanistan. And this is because particularly the Taliban has gained control over some border areas across these provinces. For instance, Islam Qala customs is currently being controlled by the Taliban militants. This is what the militant group is claiming. But the Afghan government and local government in Herat province reject such claim by the Taliban, saying that Afghan security forces have pushed back the Taliban from this key area in located on border close to the Iranian border in western Herat province of Afghanistan. In the meantime, the Taliban also claim that they are currently controlling Istanbul Dagh. That is also another key border point between Afghanistan and Pakistan and southern Afghanistan. In the meantime, Tur Hundi is also considered as one of the other border points that is located in northwest of Afghanistan that connects Afghanistan with Turkmenistan. The militant group also claims to have control over Sher Khan Bandar in northern Kunduz province of Afghanistan. Sher Khan Bandar also connects Afghanistan with most of Asian countries, mainly Tajikistan and Uzbekistan. In such circumstances, many have believed that the Afghan government needs to further focus on negotiating with the militant group despite the recent expansion of violence and war by the Taliban across this country. On the other hand, the Taliban claims that there would be no peace in Afghanistan until the current government, I mean the Afghan president, they want the Afghan president to resign because under the logic of the Taliban, during the presence of this government, exactly under the leadership of the President Ashraf Ghani, the people of Afghanistan will not be able to successfully reach to stability and a lasting peace. But this claim of the Taliban was soon rejected by one of the spokespersons of the Afghan president, Wahid Umar, that the Afghan government is ready to continue the talks. And he said that the first and the most important point that must be considered by the Taliban is that they firstly need to stop violence and war in this country and accept the Afghan constitution. And according to this top Afghan official, there would be a new chapter for resuming the intra-Afghan talks regarding to holding either an election or forming a transitional government.
All right. Thank you so much for that update. Of course, we're keeping a very close eye on things there in Afghanistan. Let me reporting out of Kabul. Meanwhile, Palestinians have held a funeral procession for a 17-year-old boy who was killed during an Israeli raid of a village in the occupied West Bank. Mourners carried the body of Mohammed Muni al-Tamimi through the streets to the burial grounds. The teenage boy succumbed to his wounds in the hospital a day after being shot by Israeli forces. He was shot during protests against illegal settlements in the town of Beitat near Nablus. On Friday, hundreds of Palestinians gathered in Beitat to demonstrate against Israeli aggression and its forceful confiscation of their lands. Regime forces fired tear gas and rubber bullets, injuring over 300 ralliers. Palestinians have vowed to continue the protests until they take their land back. The coronavirus pandemic continues to take its toll in Southeast Asia as the number of infections continue to rise in the region. Malaysia reported some 16,000 new cases on Saturday, the highest daily infection since the beginning of the pandemic. That brings the total caseload there to nearly 1.1 million. Meanwhile, Vietnam imposed a lockdown in the capital, Hanoi, on Saturday. That is the latest attempt to curb a serious COVID-19 outbreak that has already forced about a third of Vietnam's 100 million people to stay at home. Authorities also reported more than 7,000 new cases on Friday, the third record number of daily infections in a week. And Vietnam has seen a surge in the disease since late April. Russia has reported nearly 24,000 coronavirus infections, taking the overall caseload to more than 6 million. Authorities also say nearly 800 people have died from the disease during the past day. The number of new fatalities is a repeat of the all-time high in a single day since the pandemic broke out there. Overall, COVID-related death toll has exceeded 153,000. Russia has been in the grip of a surge in cases, with authorities blaming it on the Delta variant. Some officials have suggested recently that infections have started to decline, especially in Moscow. Russia is the worst hit country in Europe by the pandemic in terms of both infections and deaths. And now to Australia, where anti-lockdown protesters have clashed with police in the city of Sydney as anger boils over due to a month-long restriction driven by the Delta variant of COVID-19. Several protesters were arrested in the capital city of New South Wales. Similar rallies were also held in Melbourne. Protests held a day after authorities suggested that COVID restrictions could remain in place until October. New South Wales has been under strict stay-at-home orders since late June. However, the state has broken records for daily caseloads in recent days. On Saturday, it reported the biggest daily rise in infections, registering 163 cases. Authorities have already declared a national emergency there. The recent outbreak of the virus is largely blamed on the Delta variant and has also prompted restrictions, in other Australian states. Around half of Australia's 25 million population is now under a lockdown. And Iran has reported more than 18,000 new daily coronavirus infections, taking the total caseload to over 3,600,000. 260 more people have succumbed to the disease during the span of 24 hours. That brings the number of fatalities to over 88,500. The National Virus Task Force has implemented restrictions to stem the deadly virus. It has ordered government offices and banks in Tehran and Alborz provinces to close for 6 days. The restrictions also include a ban on road travel to and from the two provinces. High-risk businesses have also been shut down across the worst-hit areas. Well, the death toll from the monsoon rains triggered floods and landslides has risen to 129 in the western Indian state of Maharashtra. Officials say that dozens of people are still missing. The Army and the Navy and Air Force have joined rescuers in their search for survivors and to help those who remain stranded. Rescue operations were hampered due to submerged roads and flooded rivers. Heavy rains in India's west coast has forced authorities to move people out of vulnerable areas as they release water from dams that were threatening to overflow. Hundreds of villages and towns have been left without electricity and drinking water. India's Meteorological Department has issued red alerts for several regions in the state, warning of persistent heavy rainfall over the next few days. And that brings us to the end of this World News Bulletin. Thank you so much for being with us. See you soon.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight.
A scientist advising the British government has accused ministers of allowing infections to rip through the younger population in an effort to bolster levels of immunity before the NHS faces winter pressures. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalists Ian Sample and Heather Stewart. The piece is titled Sage Advisor Claims Ministers Trying to Get As Many As Possible Infected with COVID. Scientists advising the British government has accused ministers of allowing infections to rip through the younger population in an effort to bolster levels of immunity before the National Health Service faces winter pressures. The allegation comes after England's remaining COVID restrictions were eased on Monday, 19th of July, with nightclubs throwing open their doors for the first time in the pandemic and all rules on social distancing and wearing face masks dropped even as infections run high. Ministers were made aware of scientists' concerns about reopening nightclubs and other crowded, close contact and poorly ventilated venues without testing or other checks in place. On Monday, 19th of July, Boris Johnson made the surprise announcement that COVID passports will be required for such settings, but not until the end of September, in 2 months' time. What we're seeing is a decision by the government to get as many people infected as possible, as quickly as possible, while using rhetoric about caution as a way of putting the blame on the public for the consequences, said Professor Robert West, a health psychologist at University College London, who participates in Sage's behavioural science subgroup. It looks like the government judges that the damage to health and healthcare services will be worth the political capital it will gain from this approach, Professor Robert West said, adding that ministers appear to believe the strategy is now sustainable, unlike last year, because of the vaccine rollout. A large wave of infections coupled with mass vaccination would push the United Kingdom closer to herd immunity, where enough people in the population are resistant to the coronavirus that it no longer spreads. The threshold for herd immunity with the Delta variant of the coronavirus is unclear, but scientists estimate that the transmission would need to be blocked in about 85% of the population. Ministers have repeatedly denied that achieving herd immunity by letting cases rise is the government's goal. Last Monday's easing of restrictions, moved social distancing, the work-from-home order, and legal requirements around wearing face masks through ministers, though ministers called on the public to remain cautious. The move prompted a flurry of regional mandates to maintain face masks on public transport, including on the London Underground buses and trains and Manchester Metrolink trams. Legal limits on mixing indoors lifted at the same time, allowing all businesses to reopen. The change in rules led some clubs to open at midnight on Sunday, 18th of July, leading to packed dance floors across England. Similar scenes in the Netherlands in recent weeks led the Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte to reimpose curbs on restaurants and nightclubs as new cases rose sevenfold. Meanwhile, the Shadow Health Secretary John Ashworth said abandoning all precaution and allowing infections to climb not only risks further restrictions in the future, it condemns thousands to long-term illness and places huge pressure on the National Health Service. Rising COVID admissions are helping exacerbate a summer NHS crisis, with operations cancelled and increasing waiting times. It means we're heading into another difficult winter, and high levels of coronavirus circulating could see a vaccine-evading variant emerge. This is an utterly reckless strategy from Boris Johnson. Data from the Office for National Statistics show that the coronavirus in England is now largely an infection among young adults. Cases in the 11 to 16-year-olds are nearly four times more common, and in 16 to 24-year-olds nearly six times more common than in 50 to 69-year-olds. While generally at low risk from the disease, young people can still develop long COVID and help fuel the epidemic, which drives up cases in those who are more vulnerable. Professor John Drury, a social psychologist at the University of Sussex, is concerned about the changes that came into force on Monday, 19th of July, such as dropping the mandate on wearing face masks, which sent a very strong signal that the COVID crisis is now less serious. Speaking in a personal capacity, Professor John Drury, who participates in meetings of the SAGE Behavioural Science Subgroup, said recent research showed that people use government policy to make judgments on risk and how to behave. The overall message is that the actions by the public, not only wearing face masks but also distancing and avoiding crowded places, are no longer required. This has already affected public behavior, he said, though those ditching COVID precautions appear to be a large minority rather than the majority. Fortunately, many people are aware of the rocketing infection rates and the risk posed to many people in society, including the most vulnerable, and are continuing to wear face masks and keep their distance out of solidarity as much as self-protection. A government spokesperson said, "Herd immunity has never been part of our pandemic strategy. Our approach has always been to protect the National Health Service and social care, save lives and ensure as many people as possible are vaccinated as we learn to live with COVID-19. While the vaccination program has substantially weakened the link between infection and serious illness or death, we have been clear about the need to exercise personal caution as we ease restrictions. We are encouraging settings to make use of the National Health Service COVID pass by requiring either proof of full vaccination or a negative test, and we reserve the right to mandate certification if necessary to reduce transmission."
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri wa salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagin.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. The days leading to Ghadir are related to Wilaya. Wilaya, there's hadith. Ma nudiya bi shay'in kama nudiya bil wilaya. There was nothing in Islam that was called towards the way wilaya was. Why? The hadith explains, because everything else is going to be protected by wilaya. Salat is protected by wilaya. Before we had the Islamic government in Iran, how was prayer performed? Go back to your history books. Those who still live amongst us that have experience from that time, what did people know about prayer? Where were the masajid? Where were the jama'ah prayers? Where was the meaning of prayer? Where was the tawheed in prayer? Knowledge of the basics of prayer were not there. Quran, that is one of the most important elements of prayer. We have hadith that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala made prayer wajib in order that at least five times a day you read some Quran. Okay. Who was looking into the Quran? The basic reading of the Quran, most people were not able to read the Quran. Even Arabs weren't able to read the Quran. Iranians weren't able. Who was looking for the? Yeah, a few people for fun or for business, for making money, the recitation of the Quran, proper reciters invited here, there, paid to recite Quran. How many public, again, remember the factory, working this person, knowing how to read the Quran, that person, that's one thing. But on a mass scale, after the Islamic government is established, most people aren't able to read the Quran. And you have many of those who memorize the Quran, recite it very well, tafsir books, tafsir sessions, without Islamic government. Forgotten. Out here, we have these centers. Is this all the Muslims that we have? And then even if we have programs and some Muslims come, are we implementing what Islam says? Even the personal aspects of it. With all the distractions that are there, even though we know certain things are wrong, many of us get involved with a lot of wrong. Wilaya is what preserves this. Preserves salah, preserves zakat, preserves ahkam of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. If we talk about wilaya, we need to understand wilaya, what the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi was giving us on the day of Ghadir. Again, the day of Ghadir is not the day of showing the people Ali ibn Abi Talib has the knowledge of the Prophet. That has been explained elsewhere at other times. It's not the day that the Prophet explained how great of a person Ali ibn Abi Talib is. It's the day that the Prophet explained wilaya needs to continue by Ali and those who are like Ali or those who Ali says from his progeny and whatever else that's related to that. And this is very important. Today it's very important for us. We cannot, the same way that if you understand the wilaya in Islam and you understand how important it is, you cannot be indifferent about wilaya in a general sense, number one. You can't also be indifferent about the person who is qualified and has that responsibility. You can't be indifferent. That's what they did after, less than 2 months after Ghadir. Like most people, they weren't horrible people, but the problem was they were indifferent. And those, the bad people, took advantage of that. You can't be indifferent about wilaya. And you can't be indifferent about the person who is rightfully the wali. During the time of the occultation, that extends the concept of wilaya that was explained in Ghadir by the Prophet, is explained for the time of the occultation of the Imam by the Imam and by previous Imams. The Imam of our time has spoken about this, and the previous Imams have as well. During this time, wilaya is with fuqaha adl, ulama adl, the scholars, meaning those who have the deepest knowledge that a non-ma'soom can have, that are very adamant about implementing those laws in their own lives first and foremost. First and foremost. No matter how much money is that in the treasury, none of that is mine as an individual. That is public funds. It needs to be used. Whether that money is there or not, it makes zero difference for me because it has nothing to do with me. That's if you have a person that has this qualification, one who Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will then guide his thoughts and is able to identify the kuffar, the munafiqun, their plots, those who come and smile but backstab you, those who come forward, act like they're religious, but they want to get involved with those public funds and steal them. Ghadir is about wilaya and supporting the wali. Wilaya is not limited to the time of the Prophet, and it's not limited to the time of the presence of the Imams. The same way that when the Prophet was passing, it was necessary for the Prophet to say how this wilaya is going to happen when he's not around. It was necessary for the Imam of our time to tell the people how to go about the idea of wilaya when he's not around. That's exactly why he appointed the first, then the second, then the third, and then the fourth na'ib. And then afterwards told us what to do. The last na'ib, there's no more particular individuals. أما الحوادث الواقعة فارجعوا فيها إلى رواة حديثنا. Upholding Ghadir is upholding wilaya. While we remember Ali ibn Abi Talib salamullahi alayhi wa arwahuna fida, to think that Ghadir is limited to Ali is a disservice and injustice to Ali ibn Abi Talib. And it's a complete misunderstanding of Ghadir. When you understand it, you realize the whole purpose of this is to say wilaya doesn't end with the Prophet. If this wilaya is ma nudiya bi shay'in kama nudiya bil wilaya, it's that important. Can't be limited to the time of the Prophet. How do we perform after you, Ya Rasulullah? Man kuntu mawla fa'aliyun mawla. That itself tells us that when the occultation occurs, wilaya cannot be limited to the presence of the Imams. So during the time of the occultation, 1100 years plus, forget about wilaya. There's no wilaya in Islam. There is no wilaya for us to implement. So we're going to forget about this. Just talk about history in Ghadir, on the Eid of Ghadir. Until the Imam comes, then we'll have wilaya again. The whole idea of Ghadir is that wilaya does not end with one ma'asum or for any particular time. It continues, and the one who is the wali tells you what happens afterwards. The same way that each Imam told the people who the next wali was. The Imam of our time and Imam al-Askari explained to people what happens, how does this wilaya work during the time of the minor occultation and during the time of the major occultation. And I hope that we all, at least those of us who associate ourselves with the Ahlul Bayt and celebrate and respect Ghadir, are able to understand this and inshallah have this. And understand that supporting wilaya today is supporting Ghadir. And not supporting wilaya today is making a joke out of Ghadir if we support it, if we celebrate Ghadir. The same way that those who celebrate Jesus do not celebrate the Prophet are making a joke out of prophethood. Those who celebrate Musa but do not celebrate Jesus are making a joke out of prophethood. Remembering the Prophet and not the awliya after him is making a joke of the message of the Prophet. And considering the Ahlul Bayt to be awliya, and then in their absence there's no wilaya, is making a joke of Ghadir.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Mateen شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمن
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc. You wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
For more than a decade, rich nations, those responsible for the vast majority of emissions causing the climate crisis, have failed to deliver the promised $100 billion a year to support countries in the global south in cutting greenhouse gas emissions and adapting to the intensifying impacts of the crisis. We've prepared for you an article written by Kate Blagojevich. The piece is titled, COP26 will be most important summit ever, but the UK's leadership is already falling short. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Summer alone has seen scorching heat domes smother parts of the United States and Canada with record temperatures and blistering heat waves sweep across Pakistan. Torrential rain has caused devastating floods in China as well as in India, Germany, Belgium and Austria. And while fires are raging in Siberia, Madagascar is experiencing the world's first famine caused solely by the climate crisis. Even in the United Kingdom, the first extreme heat warnings were issued in recent days. New extreme weather events linked to the climate crisis have become rolling news. Their destruction and death toll are a daily reminder that the UK hosted COP26. This autumn isn't just the most important climate conference ever held, but the most important international summit of all time. With the world scientific community warning us that we have just 8 years to implement the necessary measures to avoid the most catastrophic impacts of irreversible runaway climate breakdown, failed talks are not an option. There are just 100 days until the summit begins in Glasgow, Scotland, but there's a lot to do and a long way to go if the United Kingdom is going to make it a success. Every country must bring forward targets and tangible policies for the next decade that will cut global greenhouse gas emissions enough to keep alive the goal of the Paris Climate Accord, limiting global temperature rises to just 1.5 degrees Celsius. This requires careful diplomacy, inspired leadership, and an example set for others to follow. So much of the summit's success hinges on the credibility of the United Kingdom's presidency when the negotiations get tough, credibility that depends on action and not words. British government claims to be a world leader on climate action. Yes, it has some of the so-called toughest climate targets, but targets alone won't cut greenhouse gas emissions. Even UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson's own climate advisers warned just last month that it is failing to match rhetoric with action. Looking at the key areas in which global action must be delivered at COP26 in Glasgow, through the lens of domestic action from the British government, it's actually quite worrying to think that we're in charge. Take fossil fuel. In May, the International Energy Agency, the IEA, the world's foremost energy think tank, made clear that there must be no new oil, gas, or coal projects approved anywhere beyond 2021 if the world is to stay on track for meeting the 1.5-degree Celsius target. There can be no success at COP26 unless this is tackled head-on, with a commitment from leaders across the world to phase out fossil fuels altogether. But how is Boris Johnson, or the president of COP26, Alok Sharma, going to make such demands if this government fails to rule out a new oil field in the North Sea that intends to extract 150 million barrels of oil? Even Joe Biden's climate envoy, John Kerry, has warned against the plan. It's a similar story when it comes to international climate finance. For more than a decade, rich nations, those responsible for the vast majority of greenhouse gas emissions causing the climate crisis, have failed to deliver the promised $100 billion a year to support countries in the global south in cutting greenhouse gas emissions and adapting to the intensifying impacts of the crisis. Yet this broken promise is out of date. The Global Climate Summit must deliver a significant increase on that $100 billion to address the social, cultural, and economic losses and damage caused by escalating climate impacts. But as the nation leading these talks, the British government has yet again set a terrible precedent by failing to provide genuinely new funds for international climate finance, at the same time as slashing the UK's aid budget. This threatens millions of lives and livelihoods around the world and fundamentally sours relations with developing nations, which did so little to cause the world's climate crisis. Hypocrisy is rife, but it doesn't stop there. There's also the small matter of ensuring all nations bring forward targets, policies, and robust plans that actually deliver necessary emission cuts from every country by strict deadlines that will stop temperatures spiraling out of control. These plans must come with firm rules to ensure that governments don't simply rely on carbon offsetting as a means to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, where one usually rich company or country buys credits from projects in usually poor countries elsewhere. Offsets have a track record of being ineffective and giving license to polluters to continue with business as usual. But in any case, shifting responsibilities simply won't work. Global greenhouse gas emissions must be brought to zero by 2050. Though the British government has ambitions to make London the global hub for the trade of voluntary carbon offsets, in other words, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Rishi Sunak, wants the United Kingdom to become the centre of greenwashing, cashing in on attempts to dodge required emissions cuts. Again, Britons are setting an appalling example for others to follow. COP26 is our last best chance of tackling the worst effects of the climate crisis. As host, the United Kingdom is pivotal to its success. With just 100 days to go, we need to see some bold announcement from the government demonstrating that it's willing to get its own house in order and inspire others to step up. This starts by committing to end all new fossil fuel projects immediately and supporting workers to transition. Rolling out a nationwide energy efficiency program with plans and money to decarbonize home heating must swiftly follow. it must U-turn on plans to scrap the aid budget and announce reinvest cash for countries in the global south to tackle and adapt to climate change. And it must quash plans to turn London into an offsetting hub, instead making it mandatory for all financial institutions and large companies to prioritize cutting their emissions at source over the next decade. Only through practicing what it preaches will the British government really be able to walk the walk in Glasgow. Failure to do so leaves our world-leading targets for cutting greenhouse gas emissions sounding blatantly hollow and risking jeopardizing the talks altogether.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Imam Khomeini guided the Iranian nation to determine their own fate. June 4, 2021. The televised speech delivered on June 4, 2021 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the 32nd demise anniversary of Imam Khomeini. Greetings be upon him. Since the first day when the Islamic Republic was formed, ill-intentioned personalities, enemies, and those inside and outside the country who could not digest and tolerate that great phenomena said that the Islamic Republic would not survive more than 2 months. And sometimes they said that it would not survive more than 6 months. 1 year and thereafter that it would be overthrown. Well, Imam's power and decisiveness and subsequently the great victories of the Iranian nation in the 8-year war and various other events extinguished that approach. In other words, the prayer gradually diminished and it was almost non-existent at the end of Imam's life. But after his demise, ill-intentioned individuals were resuscitated again and their hope was boosted again, thus repeating their cliché dreams in the form of predictions. A very old and derelict party with extravagant claims made an announcement in the year 1369 saying that the Islamic Republic was standing at the edge of a precipice. Actually, this was what the announcement meant. Subhanallah, hamdan lillah, wa la ilaha illallah. Subhanallah, hamdan lillah, wa la ilaha illallah. Allahu Akbar. In other words, if it makes one more move, it will be done for. This was said in the year 1369. A few years later, another group and another party, they unfortunately held governmental positions. They were among the members of the Islamic Parliament at that time, wrote a letter saying that there was little time left for the Islamic Republic. It implied that the Islamic Republic would not survive more than a few days and that it should be overthrown. That was another party, and they more or less had the same dispositions as the other party. It shared the same beliefs with it to some extent. Before and after those people too, there were individuals, groups and parties who used to say the same things inside or outside the country, under the aegis of foreigners and the enemies of the Islamic Republic, and their statements would be broadcast in the radio and other such media, foretelling the overthrow of the Islamic Republic. That is to say, they voiced their wishful thinking in the form of news, analysis, and the like, and they shared that happy news with one another.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.